It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn about the historic process of brewing beer and the role brewing played in Wisconsin history.
First, Republican Mike Pence campaigned in Waukesha last night. It was his first solo appearance since becoming Donald Trump's vice presidential running mate. Governor Scott Walker introduced him.
In his speech, Pence made the case to vote for Trump, saying he's the only choice.
If you want a president who will build strong borders and enforce our laws, if you want a president who will upend the status quo in Washington, D.C., and appoint justices who will uphold our Constitution, we have one choice, and that man is ready. This team is ready. Our party is ready, and we must elect Donald Trump as the 45th president of the United States of America.
WPR's assistant news director, Kyla Calvert-Mason, based in Milwaukee, was at last night's rally and joined us to talk about it. Kyla, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, we just heard a bit of the message from Donald Trump's vice presidential pick from that campaign stop in Waukesha yesterday. How did that message go over with voters who were there listening?
I think they were excited. I think that that was exactly what they wanted to hear. People seemed enthusiastic about that message. I talked with some voters beforehand who did not support Trump in the primary. Waukesha is a Republican stronghold, and it went very strongly for Ted Cruz in April. 61% of the folks who voted in the Republican primary in that county in April voted for Cruz. And so I talked with people who were maybe not that enthusiastic initially about supporting Trump, not that convinced that he was the kind of conservative that they are more comfortable supporting. And, you know, that was the message that they were looking for, that there was going to be conservative leadership, coming out of this ticket.
And Governor Scott Walker was there campaigning with Mike Pence yesterday. How did that change the tone of what you heard, or maybe bolster his credentials? Because, as you said, that was not an area that supported Donald Trump in the primary. And back then, Scott Walker was not in a supportive relationship with Trump. So what changed?
Well, I think the message that we heard sort of over and over again last night in Waukesha was that conservative voters only have one choice in this election, and it's Donald Trump. And that was very much the message of Scott Walker. He called Mike Pence a Scott Walker Republican. He introduced him to the crowd as one of us and a full-fledged conservative, or a full-spectrum conservative. Jim Sensenbrenner said very similar things. He's the Republican congressman that represents Waukesha. Robin Voss and Scott Fitzgerald were also there with that same message saying, you know, Mike Pence is one of us, and this shows us that Trump is going to be the kind of conservative that we were concerned he wasn't, you know, earlier in this race.
And earlier in the race, Governor Walker had seemed reluctant to endorse Donald Trump. Did you see any traces of that reluctance on exhibit with Mike Pence yesterday, or does it seem as though Governor Walker has turned a corner on that?
Oh, no. I would say that the corner has definitely been turned, if that's a phrase that you can use. Scott Fitzgerald engaged the whole crowd in some chanting about being on the Trump train. So it was very much sort of all in for this ticket.
What else did Mike Pence himself say?
You know, he talked about his own conservative credentials. He talked about his leadership in Indiana, about making the right kinds of investments in infrastructure and innovation and paring down the bureaucracy of government and relieving people from, you know, burdensome tax bills through reform and tax cutting. So he both sort of talked about all the money that he's saved taxpayers in Indiana, but also touted the amount of investment that they've done in his term and in infrastructure in his state.
And did Pence get into it all Trump's plan for what he and Mike Pence might do together during that first couple years in the White House, their vision?
You know, I don't really expect any political campaign speech like this one to have a lot of specifics in it, and I don't think that this one necessarily did. You know, as we heard at the clip that was played right before we started, he did talk about the issues that are important to conservative voters and making the case that those issues will be important in a Trump Pence White House. He talked about how Trump will bring the kind of Republican leadership to the White House that Pence has brought to Indiana, that Walker has brought to Wisconsin, doing the kinds of things that I just mentioned, you know, investing in infrastructure, investing in innovation and cutting the bureaucracy, giving people choice over where they send their kids to school through programs like vouchers and things like that, and also, you know, relieving the tax burden.
Kyla, do you have a sense how important it is in Wisconsin for the Trump campaign to carry this portion of southeastern Wisconsin where this campaign stop was held yesterday?
Well, my sense is that's sort of the big Republican one of the big Republican strongholds in the state, and that sort of the direction that the party moves in comes in many ways sort of out of that part of the state. So, you know, this is where Scott Walker draws a lot of his strength, and, you know, to get those people behind Trump is going to make a big difference, I think, for their campaign now through November.
We're talking with Kyla Calvert-Mason right now. She's WPR's assistant news director based in Milwaukee. And she's with us to talk about yesterday's campaign stop in Waukesha with the Republican vice presidential nominee Mike Pence. And he was campaigning there with Governor Scott Walker. And Kyla, we began talking about what it might mean for the governor to appear there with Mike Pence. And at the end of this event, did you get the sense that the people who were there had come away with something different, seeing the governor there endorsing Mike Pence and essentially the Trump presidency?
Certainly. I mean, you know, at the end of the event, people didn't sort of file out quickly. People went up to the stage. They wanted to, you know, get their time with Pence if they could, get their picture with Pence. I think people were excited. I mean, I think that that's also the kind of person who tends to turn out for these sort of events. You know, if you're sort of on the fence, maybe you're not going to show up on a Wednesday night without a lot of notice. But it seemed to me that the crowd was enthusiastic and, you know, by and large, was sort of already on board with the Trump-Pence team.
And would you expect, given the tone of what you saw last night, to see exactly more of this same kind of thing, Scott Walker out there helping to gather votes for the Trump campaign?
I would imagine so. I mean, all this week, Trump and Pence are visiting and campaigning in battleground states all across the country. So I think that, you know, sort of bringing out these Pence's conservative credentials in states where they think that's going to make a difference is what we're going to see a lot of between now and November. And so when they're in Wisconsin, I'm sure they're going to be, you know, rallying Walker and Voss and Fitzgerald, all of the people that we saw in Waukesha last night.
Are there similarities, as far as you know, between the policies that Governor Scott Walker has put through in Wisconsin and Mike Pence has done in Indiana?
Well, what I know from last night, at least, is that when Pence was in Congress, when he joined Congress, that Senator Schumer from New York criticized a lot of the House Republicans for being Scott Walker Republicans. And in his first ever tweet, Mike Pence thanked him for, you know, what he considered a great compliment to be considered a Scott Walker Republican. So to the extent that their specific policies have been very similar, I can't really speak to that. But, you know, they very much consider themselves to be part of a group of people who think in the same way and support the same ideas.
Now, one other story came out of that event yesterday. A Washington Post reporter was denied entry into the rally last night. And this comes in the wake of the Trump campaign revoking press credentials for a number of publications, including the Washington Post. What do you know about the details on what happened?
Well, what the Washington Post reported was that their reporter was denied a credential by the volunteers at the media table and then tried to enter the rally through the general, with the general admission, sort of general entry. And according to the Washington Post, their reporters have done that without problem ever since the Trump campaign first revoked their credentials quite a while ago now. And when the reporter tried to do that, Security people at the event said that he couldn't enter the venue. This is according to the reporters, said he couldn't enter the venue if he had a cell phone or a laptop, even though there weren't necessarily similar restrictions on, you know, the general public who were entering the event. The security people reportedly called over Waukesha County Sheriff's deputies who patted the reporter down to make sure that the reporter wasn't carrying his cell phone. And he was still denied entry, according to, you know, what the Washington Post is reporting about that this morning. I did reach out to the Waukesha Sheriff's Department, and they sent back an email saying that they're looking into it, but I haven't heard anything else back thus far.
So we'll stand by for more details on that one. Kyla, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Kyla Calvert-Mason is WPR's assistant news director based in Milwaukee, and she was at last night's rally and joining us there to talk about it.
Right now, we take a look at a big part of Wisconsin's history, beer brewing. This year at Old World Wisconsin, there's a historic brewing program. The institution is partnering with the Museum of Beer and Brewing to teach the entire process of making beer and educate Wisconsinites on the heritage involved in beer and brewing here in the state.
Dan Friest joins us now. He's the director of Old World Wisconsin, and also with us is Gary Luther, past president of the Museum of Beer and Brewing. Dan and Gary, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having us.
Good afternoon. Glad to be here.
Dan, I'm going to start with you. Where did the idea of having a historic brewing program come from?
Well, as you said in your introduction, the history and culture of beer brewing is such an important part of Wisconsin, both past and present, that we really felt that it was a void in the history that we're presenting here at Old World Wisconsin. So for many years, the idea of doing something related to historic beer brewing has been bounced around as an idea. And fortunately, we were able to meet up with folks like Gary and others from the Museum of Beer and Brewing in Milwaukee, group of folks that have experience brewing beer as well as a love of the history of beer brewing. And it was a natural partnership that came together. And so we've launched this new program where guests at Old World Wisconsin can now see beer being brewed using historic methods.
And Dan, tell us a little bit more about that. What is the program like?
Well, it's not something that we do on a daily basis at this point. There are actually select Saturdays throughout our season in which we have this scheduled. And it takes place in a small log building that we've converted to a brew house in our German area of Old World, Wisconsin. If folks are familiar with Old World, they know that we have the property divided up into different areas representing different ethnic groups that settled in Wisconsin in the 19th and early 20th century. So in our German area, where, you know, beer brewing is a good fit, we've taken this this log structure, and Gary and his team of volunteers have converted it into a brew house.
And Gary, you're doing the demos there, showing what this process of beer brewing was like going back to the 19th century. What's different when we contrast how beer is brewed now compared to back then, what you're doing with folks?
Well, Helena, the science is actually the same, but the technology has certainly changed. When the immigrants came to the United States back in the 1850s, they brought with them their culture, as well as the brewing skills that they had gained in Europe. So when they came, they used the rudimentary tools of the time to put together breweries, farm breweries, sometimes home breweries, and they started brewing just as much like the craft brewers to do today, but where today they're using stainless steel and thermometers and things of that nature. Back in the 1850s, they had to do, once again, with the tools of the day, which were normally wooden vats, wooden barrels, wood fires, ice being harvested from ponds, and so on. So the science is the same, but the technology has definitely changed.
So, Gary, is that all the stuff that you're using, ice and wooden vessels and things like that?
That's what we are doing, yes, exactly. We have a hand mill. just a little two-roller mill that we use, and the mashing vessel is actually what they would use back in those days. Would have been called a mashing in Lauterton, but it's a half wooden barrel with a false bottom on it with a wooden slots in the false bottom to be able to filter the beer as they do today, but on across wood. And it runs into, we collect that liquid and put it into a copper, big open copper kettle that something like they would have used back in the 1850s and heat it with a wood fire to boil it. The materials that we use are actually, we grow our own hops, legacy hops from back in, that they would have used back in those days. And we use malted barley along with that.
And is all that grown there at Old World, Wisconsin, or do you bring it from somewhere else?
Well, right now the hops are all grown at Old World, Wisconsin. We don't need a lot of hops, but we do have a hop garden with legacy hops in it. And we are propagating barley right now. And the barley we happened to find was in North Dakota State University's library, seed library. They gave us 15 pounds of this grain to grow. And we propagated last year for the first time. We got 90 pounds out of it. This year we might get 400, and we'll keep on going until we have enough barley to do our own malting, which is also something that the brewers would have been doing back in the 1850s.
And Gary, you mentioned mashing it and letting the beer filter through, but can you walk us through a little bit what happens if we're going to see this actual beer be made, and how long does all this take?
Oh, certainly. Well, the actual brewing process itself in the brew house, as Dan mentioned, that's about a 6 or 7 hour process. And we start at about 9 o'clock in the morning heating up water to a boil, or up to a temperature of 180 degrees. We need this hot water to mix with the malt, so that we come through with a biochemical process that takes place, to convert the starches in the grain into sugars. So we mix this ground malt that we've had with the hot water, and we come to some temperature between 150 and 160 degrees, depending upon the type of beer style we want to make. And with this mixture, we let it rest for about an hour, and it prepares itself to make the style of liquid that we need for the beer style that we want. Then we separate this liquid from the grains themselves with the husks and all the insoluble materials to have a clear solution the brewer calls a wort. And this wort is then boiled for about 90 minutes together with hops to give it the bittering that we want and other flavor components. We then cool it down, and we cool it across an old-fashioned piece of equipment that they call a cool ship. And the boiling wort, which is at 212 degrees, is poured into this flat surface vessel, which isn't very deep, and the heat flashes out very rapidly from it to cool the wort down, the liquid down to about 140 degrees. And the remainder of the temperature down to what our fermentation should take place is done with an ice vessel called a swimmer to cool the wort down. And when it gets to 70 degrees, we give the yeast to it and let it go and ferment.
We're talking about the historic beer brewing exhibit at Old World, Wisconsin right now. I'm talking with Gary Luther, past president of the Museum of Beer and Brewing, and also Dan Friese, director of Old World, Wisconsin. And Dan, if I'm not mistaken, you said something like you're going to heat this up to, did you say 180 degrees is what Gary was just saying? And on a hot summer day, in any case, you're working with a giant vat of hot liquid in the summertime. What is that like for the people who are involved making the beer and those people standing around this fire?
Yeah, it's just warm. And of course, if folks have been to Old World, Wisconsin, they know that this time of year, even with the hot weather, you know, we're cooking on wood-fired stoves and working in blacksmith shops, forges. So the past was not always pleasant, particularly during this hot weather. But the one thing that the Gary and his team are really committed to is getting it right in terms of recreating the processes that were used in the 19th century, even though they know because they're all knowledgeable of the beer brewing process, that there is indeed an easier way to get there.
they're committed to rediscovering the old ways of making beer, which, for the most part, you know, were never written down. So it's really almost like an archaeological project where they're trying to uncover information and learn from what has been written down. And then a lot of it is experimentation, just to apply what they are learning to the actual process of making beer.
And Gary, what does the beer taste like? You're using these time-honored artisanal methods. Does the beer taste better?
Well, right now, Helena, what we're doing is we're fermenting the beer out to where it's finished its fermentation process and just tasting it a bit, and then we dispose of the beer. Because we aren't that far that we need to prepare it for selling and everything like that. But the beer tastes probably the way it would have been back in 1850. If, you know, back in those days, they didn't have a high alcohol beer. There was a lot of body in the beer because it was actually a food substance that the people were drinking at that time. So it's quite tasteful. Right now we're making ale styles of beers, and once we get our ice together, we'll start brewing lager beers later on in the year.
And a little sneak peek of what's ahead. Dan, just briefly, anything else you've got planned for this program?
Well, like I said, you know, we're doing it just on a limited basis right now, and we're really trying to master the process, but also gauge the public's interest in this program, and it's in the whole idea of recreating historic beer. So we're starting out small, just trying to learn the process and engage our guests as much as we can in the actual process. One of the things that Gary and his team have done is find safe ways to involve visitors to Old World in the actual process, such as using the hand-cranked mill to grind the barley.
Well, it sounds incredible to see. Dan and Gary, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having us.
That was Dan Friis, director of Old World Wisconsin, and Gary Luther, past president of the Museum of Beer and Brewing. They joined us to talk about the historic beer brewing exhibit at Old World Wisconsin. For more information about the program, go to oldworldwisconsin.org. The next scheduled brewing date is August 13th.
We continue our series of candidate interviews for next month's primary elections here in Wisconsin. We've invited candidates in contested congressional primaries to join us on Central Time and on the Joy Cardine Show.
Today, we stay in the 6th congressional district in eastern and central Wisconsin.
Republican Glenn Grothman is the incumbent. Yesterday, we heard from Michael Slattery, one of the two Democrats running to challenge him. Today, Democratic candidate Sarah Lloyd joins the show.
The winner of the primary on Tuesday, August 9th, will be on the ballot in November facing Grothman and independent candidate Jeff Dahlke.
Sarah Lloyd joins us now. She's a candidate in the Democratic primary for the 6th Congressional District. Sarah, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Well, tell us, first of all, why you're running for Congress.
Well, I'm running for Congress because many of the folks that I meet across the 6th Congressional District are still struggling, even though we've seen some economic recovery. And we need to make sure we have an economy that's going to work for everyone. I was approached back last summer by some people and said, would you look at the race? Would you be willing to run? And I took a look and thought, yeah, you know, we're the people we've been waiting for. So we need to step up and to push back against the policies that are capturing our economy and also our democracy.
Can you tell us some about your background and how it would help you represent your district in Congress?
Yeah, so my husband and I dairy farm outside of the Wisconsin Dells in Columbia County, and I work off the farm for the Wisconsin Farmers Union and the Wisconsin Food Hub Cooperative. So with those experiences, I understand small businesses and also rural community. But I also have experience with elected office. I was elected to 2 terms on the Columbia County Board and represented my constituents there on the Health and Human Service and Nursing Home Committee. So also understand the way that the federal programs come down to the municipalities and to the people. with Medicare and Medicaid. And then I also have been appointed to the National Dairy Board by the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture. So I have experience in governance at the national level on the dairy board.
In this primary race, you and Michael Slattery have a lot of views in common on many issues. You are both farmers. I think both worked with the Farmers Union. Journal Sentinel, I think, described you as friendly rivals. How would you distinguish yourself from Michael Slattery for the voters?
Yes, I think friendly rivals is a good way of describing it. I have experience in elected office, and a lot of the work that I have done in the cooperative business development and other places in my work have been about building coalitions, building allies and shared interests together to move things forward. And that's the kind of things we need in Congress right now, to work around shared values. I also will distinguish myself from Michael Slattery in the sense that I am running a strong campaign. I am raising the resources necessary to hire staff because we do need to unseat the incumbent, Glenn Grossman, and so we need to have resources to do that. I'm raising money. I've got 3 paid staff people. I'm getting out there on the ground and can run a tough race against Grossman.
If you win the primary, as you say, you'd go on to face incumbent Glenn Grossman, what would you focus on in that general election in November?
Well, I think that people are looking for economic solutions because we can't have a situation where people are working harder than ever but still not able to make ends meet. And so we need to see where we're investing in our communities. You know, we've had federal resources come down to the local level in infrastructure development when you think about rebuilding roads. Let's expand rail infrastructure for both freight and passenger. And those can bring resources to kickstart the economy and make sure that we have good jobs. And I support that. And I think that is a role of the government. And let's also invest in the educational infrastructure. So I am strongly supporting reforming the college debt or loan situation so that we can, folks that are hold college loans can refinance those loans. And also, you know, let's make sure that there are grants and loans available to people that do want to attend technical colleges, community colleges, and four-year colleges. And that's going to be really a kickstart for the economy. And Glenn Grossman is not supporting programs that support people and communities, and he's not bringing resources back to the district. And that is something that I will prioritize in Congress.
We're talking to Sarah Lloyd. She's a candidate in the Democratic primary for the 6th Congressional District in our ongoing series of candidate interviews for next month's primary elections. Sarah, there's a Republican majority in the U.S. House. So there's likely to be a Republican majority in the U.S. House next year. If you're in that Republican-controlled House, how would you see yourself working with Republicans to pass some of those agenda items you were just talking about?
Yeah, so again, I mentioned earlier my background and professional career is working on bringing groups together, on building coalitions, and in that work, you work on shared values. So one area that I think is a real opportunity in Congress right now is actually the issue of trade deals. We have seen pushback from both sides of the aisle on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, for example. And this is a place where people, workers, communities, farmers are really standing up and saying, when you think of the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, or the Central American CAFTA, and these other trade deals, we were promised that these would impact positively our communities and our families and businesses, and that's not happened. And so we need to push back. We need to reject the Trans-Pacific Partnership as it's written. And there actually are Republicans and Democrats that want to see that happen. So I want to work on that together. I mentioned earlier the issue of college loans and being able to refinance and also make college more affordable. You now have key economic sectors like the realtors, for example, who are realizing that they need people coming out of college to be able to buy homes, to be able to participate in the economy fully, that they're not being able to do when they're saddled with heavy debts. And that's something now that both Republicans and Democrats are really realizing that it's a drag on the economy. So there's another area where we can work together. So let's find the areas that we can work together on and push forward positive economic change.
Getting back to those trade agreements you mentioned, obviously those have been a big issue in the presidential race so far. With something like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, are you thinking scrap the whole thing, or are there changes that could be made, safeguards in it, that would make you more open to it? And same thing for something like NAFTA. Are there changes you'd like to see retroactively do a trade deal like that?
Yes. Well, with regards to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, you know, one of the issues that we have on the trade deals in general is that the Fast Track Trade Authority was passed, which actually gave the president executive power so that Congress could not go in and amend or filibuster anything in the trade deals. And that's a serious impact to the constitutional separation of powers, that Congress is responsible for regulating trade. So aside from the specifics of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, we have to end fast-track authority because that's really the check that the people had on these deals. With regards to kind of the specifics of what we need in the deals, we need fair trade that will actually recognize all the member people in the supply chain. And as we live in a global world, of course we have parts being shipped overseas to then be manufactured in other places. And right now, with the way that TPP is written, it really is not assuring any sort of fairness for the people involved in the production and the manufacturing. It's really just allowing for multinational corporations to have sort of unfettered and untransparent access to the market. And so we need to make sure that that local governments and state governments can have environmental protections that they need, that it can have workers' rights and wage laws that can be enforced at the local level. And those trade deals threaten those. And so unless the TPP can be rewritten so that it's sure that, you know, the U.S. Environmental laws could be enforced, I can't accept the TPP. And the same goes with NAFTA. You know, we've taken any kind of grievance in these trade deals outside of any kind of transparent court or system and put it in some black box tribunals where people don't know what's going on. And that's not acceptable. So those are the transparency. It has to be changed in all of the trade deals.
We're talking to Sarah Lloyd, candidate for Congress in Wisconsin's 6th District Democratic primary.
And you can join us at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for the candidate? What do you think Congress should focus on next year? And if you live in the 6th Congressional District, what's the most important issue in your area? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation with Sarah Lloyd. She is a Democratic candidate in next month's primary election in the 6th Congressional District in eastern and central Wisconsin.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for the candidate? If you live in that 6th Congressional District, what's the most important issue facing your community? What are your top priorities for Congress in the coming year? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now with Gail in Fish Creek. Gail, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have one question, which I'm sure is on a lot of people's minds, especially now with Donald Trump being the big Republican. who isn't putting out his tax returns yet, and there's lots of reasons why. I'm wondering what the officials are going to start doing in Wisconsin to get the billionaires and the extremely wealthy people in Wisconsin to pay their state taxes. One in particular who is backing Trump has had an article out about her that she has absolutely not paid any state taxes in 4 out of 5 years.
Gail, thanks for the call. Of course, you're running for federal office, Sarah. But on that theme, taxation, progressive taxation levels, taxation for the wealthy, what's your position on that?
Well, we definitely need to look carefully at the taxation that's going on because a lot of times when we're asking to make sure that we have good investment in our communities and infrastructure and education, we're being told, oh, we can't afford that. You know, the federal government is broke, but it's not. And what we need to do is make sure that we're closing tax loopholes, that we are taxing profit-taking on speculation on Wall Street. We're making sure that people aren't able to hide profits offshore so that they aren't taxed. And this is really important because everyone should be paying their fair share of taxes. And a lot of times right now we hear from Congress and from other leaders that, oh, you know, we can't afford things, or, oh, people are going to have to threat that the middle class is going to have to pay more taxes, when actually we could bring a lot more revenue into the federal coffers that would assist in stimulating the economy if we actually had fair taxes and that large corporations weren't avoiding their fair share.
Thanks for the call, Gail. We'll go next to Jason in Wauwatosa. Jason, hi.
Hi. My question was how the speaker felt about corporate personhood and the Citizens United decision, and I know there's a lot of groups in Milwaukee that are trying to get that on up to politicians to talk about that, and I was wondering how she felt about that.
Thanks, Jason, for the question. So, Sarah, the Citizens United decision and campaign finance.
Yeah, thanks for that question, and that's very important to me. We have to get money out of politics, and money is not speech. And I reject that notion. Citizens United, the Supreme Court ruling, you know, really got the genie out of the bottle on that one. In Congress, you know, what I can do is make sure that I am part of co-sponsoring bills and passing bills that would limit the dark money or gray money, so that to start with, that we're making sure that people have to disclose the money that they're putting into the political races. As far as overturning Citizens United, I fully support the idea of constitutional amendment that would clarify that money is not speech and corporations are not people. That is definitely important to me. And, you know, I think it's problematic right now, for example, that we don't have a full sitting Supreme Court. And obviously that's not the House's role, but I would urge that the federal government, the Senate, act to fill the vacancy. And that also is why the presidential race is so important this time, because there are a number of 2 to 3 probably Supreme Court justices that will come up to be filled during this next presidency, and we need to make sure we have a Democrat in office. And so my running for Congress is sort of part of that larger Democratic movement to make sure that we're keeping money out of politics. Our Supreme Court is acting in the interest of the citizens and not the corporations.
Jason, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Sarah Lloyd, candidate for Congress, a Democrat in the 6th District primary next month. Still time for your questions for the candidate at 800-642-1234. Alex joins us next in Markesan. Alex, hi.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I just want to ask, what candidate, Sarah, did you support in the primary? And since we came down to, we obviously have Clinton now, what are some reasons why you can wrap your head around why you can trust Clinton as president, and considering her trustworthiness ratings are so low?
Alex, thanks for the call. So, Sarah, the Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton primary and the outcome of that, what do you think?
Yeah, so I was a strong Bernie Sanders supporter. I was actually designated by the Sanders campaign to attend the Democratic National Convention as a member of the Rules Committee. So I met as a member of the Rules Committee on Saturday and was part of the work that was done to come up with a binding commission that will reduce the power of the superdelegates. And I think that was a good progress in the right direction. I will support Hillary Clinton going forward. And the reason that I will do that is, you know, I mentioned earlier the Supreme Court is at stake, and that is essential. If we think about all of the important things that we need to make sure that our economy is going to work for real people, for farmers, for communities, for workers, we need to have Democratic platform in order, and we need to be able to push that through. We have a great opportunity to retake the U.S. Senate with Russ Feingold's campaign. Wisconsin will be important. With Hillary Clinton in the White House, we're going to start getting an audience and can with the Senate and the presidency to push these things through. And that's why we need to make sure that we're all doing what we can up and down the ticket to get those things forward. But I look at the economic urgency because we need to make sure the economy is going to support people. I look at the trade deal issue with the Senate and the presidency. And Donald Trump is really not fit to be the president, and it's quite frightening to me. And so the stakes are so high that we need to work. And if people are not feeling that sure right now about Hillary Clinton, get out there and work for Feingold. Get out there and work for me in the sixth. Get out and work for somebody at the state level that's going to work for you. Because the more activity that we have as Democrats, the better policies that we can get in place. And there's too much at stake for folks to sit home.
Alex, thanks for the call. Sarah wanted to ask about a big issue, one of the big unsolved issues in American politics, sure to come up for the next Congress, immigration and immigration reform. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, we must have comprehensive immigration reform because right now we have a system that's completely unworkable. It's not supporting employers. It's not supporting the employees, whether they be U.S. born or immigrant. And we've created this situation where we have all these people living in the shadows, and it's not good for our communities or for people. We need to recognize that we are in a transnational labor situation. You know, we have, for the most part, if you're thinking about immigrant workers in Wisconsin, we have people from Mexico coming up to do jobs in sectors of the economy, agriculture, restaurant, hotel, and service sector that we're not finding U.S.-born workers to do. So we need to recognize that. You know, we've heard other candidates talk about deporting 11 million people and building a wall. Deporting 11 million people, which is what's estimated to be the number of undocumented immigrants in the U.S., is completely not feasible. It just wouldn't work. But it would also tear apart families and lives. And that's not who we are as Americans, as a nation of immigrants.
And we'll leave it there. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Sarah Lloyd. She's a candidate for Congress in the 6th District Democratic primary. We talked to the other candidate in that primary race, Michael Slattery, yesterday at this time. The primary election itself takes place on Tuesday, August 9th. And you can find a lot more information about Election Day, where to vote, how to vote, and candidate interviews from us here at Wisconsin Public Radio and our friends over at Wisconsin Public Television. Find all that and lots of other voting information at wisconsinvote.org. That's wisconsinvote.org. August is just around the corner, and if you're the glass half empty sort of person, that means summer is mostly gone.
Well, today on Central Time, we're asking you, what are you still hoping to do before summer is over? Is there a trip that you're still looking to take, or maybe a bike ride or a boat ride? Maybe a project that still needs to get done.
We're going to take your calls later in the show, and you can always post your summer bucket list items over on the Central Time Facebook page. Got plans to go. We're going to do a weekend in La Crosse. I mean, that's carved in stone at this point, so that'll happen. That'll be fun. I like going over to the western side of the state.
That's a good one. It's beautiful over there. And for us, we haven't made it to the Circus World Museum yet. That's always a favorite with
my
family.
You're a big fan.
Yeah, the kids love it, and it's such a blast from the past. It really feels like the circus distilled from what it would have been like then and a little bit of the modern touches now. It's just fascinating. I love it.
Got a couple more block parties I'm hoping to hit, and, you know, Devil's Lake. Got it. Maybe the fall, though. Maybe I'll put that on my fall bucket list and get out ahead on that one.
You got to think about what can I move to the fall and still do and not feel bad about it. We actually made a list this year of things we wanted to do this summer, and I think so far we've done 5 out of 30.
Okay, we'll get moving.
Got to get going.
And share your summer bucket list on the Central Time Facebook page.
Summer's almost gone. Summer's almost gone.